Welcome. This is the time set for oral argument on Northern Nevada panel cases. The first case today is number 69047, In Re Parental Rights as to ADL and CLB Jr. My understanding is that counsel for the children and for Paulin are going to split their time.
Yes, sir.
So will you begin, Ms. Molinar?
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right. Ms. Dixon, how are you doing today?
Very well, thank you.
All right. I'll let you folks sort this out, but you got 15 minutes.
Yes, sir.
All right.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Deanna Molinar. I represent natural mother Keandra DeBerry, co-appellant in this matter. I would like to reserve 5 minutes of rebuttal time. And before I begin, I do need to correct the record. On page 8 of my opening brief, I did state that Keandra DeBerry, that his birthday is in December of 2012, when in fact his birthday is in December of 2010. The referenced appendix and page number is correct and does reflect the birth date of 2010. But if you'll recall, Keandra DeBerry is not a subject of this matter. He is the afterborn child that did not become a ward of the state. And so what we have in this case is essentially a mother and children ripped apart by an unconstitutional requirement, bad evidence, all while the district court ignored the best interests of the children. So in the remand hearing, the parties agreed that the main testimony would be the only that's still an issue was the injury suffered by Christopher. The state had Dr. Mehta testify, who was the same doctor that testified at the adjudicatory hearing. And the decision written by the judge largely focused on her credentials. However much she's credentialed, I do want to point out that at no point did she make a diagnosis of abuse. She did testify that it is medically possible to make a diagnosis of abuse, but she did not do so in this case. She did not say that this was an intentional act, and she did not testify that this was a non-accidental injury. She could only testify that this was not consistent with the explanation given. And by her testimony, it was clear that her understanding of the explanation given was completely misunderstood. The way that she understood this injury to have been inflicted was that the child, who was approximately 1 year old at the time, held the iron to his own face or he kissed iron. And this comes from the statement made by his sister, who was the only person present during the time, who only stated Christopher kissed the iron. So that was the only explanation that she had, and that's what she was going off of. However, we do know through the testimony, Ms. DeBerry, my client, testifies that she was in another room, heard the iron fall, so by deduction, believes either the iron fell on him or something happened to where the iron fell close to him, he may have rolled over, any number of those things. However, that was not explained to the doctor at the time. In the respondent's answering brief, they do use the phrase, quote unquote, non-accidental trauma. However, that does not come from Dr. Mehta's testimony. That comes from the hearing master's findings from the February 4th, 2011 adjudicatory hearing from when Dr. Mehta testified. And Dr. Mehta did not re-review any of the photographs which she was given. So,
counsel, I understand you want to address the issues surrounding the testimony of the experts.
Yes.
But I think it important in this case for you to address the approach this court should take concerning the assertion of one's Fifth Amendment protection.
Okay, and I can do that.
And what you are asking this panel, should we agree that it should be addressed in a published opinion, what are you asking this panel to say?
I would like for this.
And as part of that consideration, I would like you to address. There appears to have been some discussion in the case about extending immunity or not. What would the rule be in an opinion regarding the Fifth Amendment assertion, and how would that be offset with respect to a grant of immunity if it were considered?
Well, Your Honor, in accordance with Lefkowitz, which is a U.S. Supreme Court case, its compulsion is what the Fifth Amendment turns on. And a person cannot be compelled to give up their Fifth Amendment right. And in many other states, they have held that a termination of parental rights, as this court's held, is it's a civil death penalty. You're taking away somebody's parental rights always and forever. That is a compulsion. So if you look at Arizona, Minnesota, Iowa, Vermont, New Jersey, and Kansas, there is very strong case law, and it is very much on point. And essentially what they say is that the court can compel therapy. They cannot, however, compel require admission as a part of therapy. If the therapist believes that that a parent has rehabilitated, then that's what they need to look at. That's what the court should be looking at. And in this case, what we saw is a behavioral change. We had two therapists testify that Ms. DeBerry was rehabilitated, and they believe that she could safely parent these children. And neither one of those therapists required an admission. It was actually the court that was requiring an admission.
And what if, what if we have a situation where the therapist indicates that an admission is necessary for this person to successfully complete therapy? I appreciate that's not what we had in this case.
Yes.
But what about that situation?
I believe in that situation, it would become a little bit more muddy, because in that situation, then it's not the state actually compelling the parent to admit. However, in this case, I think it's clear that the state is compelling the person to admit. And
in
that
light
case,
of the authorities you cited from other jurisdictions, how would you frame the rule that takes into account the concern expressed by Justice Stiglitz?
I think that we should frame our rule very similar to Minnesota. Minnesota actually has two cases that are on point that we did cite, and basically in Minnesota, they held that the state cannot penalize the parents for noncompliance with a court order impinging on their Fifth Amendment privilege. They do say that therapy without admission can be ineffective. However, it's the state that bears the burden of showing that this therapy is ineffective. The therapist is should be allowed to hold their therapy as they see fit. And once the state starts pinching themselves in the middle of that, then we run into Fifth Amendment issues. I understand that there could be concerns that it's not effective, but I don't believe that that's up to the court. If we have therapists, especially therapists that are being recommended by the Department of Family Services, saying that this is an appropriate person, this person can decide if you have been rehabilitated, and then once the person is rehabilitated, they say, no, you must admit to a crime. I think that.
So you would acknowledge that in cases in which the therapist urges admission as part of the therapy, that the Fifth Amendment is not implicated at all?
I believe if the court is keeping themselves out of it and the state is keeping themselves out of it, then I don't believe that we have as strong of an argument.
Would that require an offer or grant of immunity from the state, from prosecution?
You're asking if my client was?
No, I'm just saying in general, if the state offers immunity from prosecution, then Fifth Amendment doesn't really apply either, does it?
No, then it probably would not. But I would like the children's attorney to have some time to speak. I don't want to take up all of her time, so if I could just let her speak for a moment.
Sure.
Thank you very much.
All right, Ms. Dixon.
Good morning, Justices. Crystal Dixon, Barnum 9009 with the Children's Attorneys Project. I represent Amaya and Christopher in this case. I did want to follow up to the last question regarding the state offering immunity. In many of our cases today, the state does offer that immunity, even at a PC hearing, where they are saying anything used or anything disclosed to a treatment provider will not be used later against that parent. So that is an issue.
So you view that as transactional immunity or complete immunity? Is that sounds like what you described as a custom and practice.
It is in cases where it is not what we consider forward under cases where there are medically fragile children, think broken bones, they're really excessive physical abuse cases. It's not used there, but in most of our cases we're looking at neglect, drug abuse, homelessness, and it is in those kinds of cases it is used.
But the immunity is transactional rather than general immunity? Is it limited? So that if the state can still prove the case without the admission from the defendant, they can still proceed with prosecution?
I believe so. I don't see that, however, in the criminal aspect, which is what we had here. The mother had a concern, of course, of being criminally then prosecuted if she was admitting to the murder.
Okay.
And there was no offer of immunity in this case?
There was not. I wanted to start, Your Honors, by reminding you that this case has actually been going on since 2010. So my clients have been in the foster care system almost 10 years, or I'm sorry, almost 7 years, Your Honor. This has been very difficult for them. They were very bonded with their natural mother. When they were first removed, they were seeing her daily, Your Honor. They were placed with a maternal grandmother. They were very bonded in their family. I do not believe that the state met its burden by showing that it was in the best interest of these children that natural mother's rights were terminated. Natural mother completed her case plan within a very timely manner. Natural mother was no longer a risk, I believe, in this case. And I believe that if the doctor's letter should have been admitted in the case from 2011, we would not even be here today. Natural mother gave birth to her third child in 2010, December of 2010. That was prior to the initial adjudicatory hearing, which did not start occurring until 2011. At that time, the state, or I should say the Department of Family Services in this matter, mandated reporters actually had to call another state if they were concerned with the safety and abuse of any child. They are mandated reporters. They did not do so in this case because they knew Natural Mother was already working on her case plan, was already safe, was already visiting those children, was already doing what she needed to do to safely reunify.
Just to confirm, where are your clients and with whom are they staying?
My clients are currently with their maternal uncle and aunt in South Carolina, where they are still visiting with Natural Mother, and they are living with them now. They have been for the last couple of years.
Okay. All right, thank you. Did you want to say anything further? You'd be eating into the rebuttal time.
We'll leave it for the rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Justices. My name is Ron Cordes with the Clark County District Attorney's Office. I'm appearing on behalf of the Clark County Department of Family Services today. The questions that you have raised relative to the transactional immunity, the District Attorney's position, as well as the Department's support of that, is that a no-contest plea is offered to parents initially in cases to afford them a opportunity to engage in services. The specific agreement that we offer is that the no contest plea itself and any statements that they make to treatment providers would not be used in the criminal prosecution. That is the specific agreement that we make with all parents initially in cases. In this specific case, I could not tell you that that offer was made. Unfortunately, I was not the attorney of record early in this case, as has been represented. It began in 2010. We did have an office policy at that time that even the five and under cases, abuse and neglect, would receive that type of offer. So I would anticipate that it was made, but I would not have proof of that today for the record.
In this case, it was DFS that was requiring the admission, isn't that correct, rather than therapist?
That's correct. Okay. These cases raise a very difficult scenario, as you can imagine, that often we are faced with unknown explanations for injuries. And as the Nevada legislature has spoken, that can be a basis for unfitness of a parent if a child is injured while in their care and there is not a reasonable explanation to the injury. The only explanation that Ms. DeBerry made in this specific case was that from her daughter's statement that the child kissed the iron. Once that explanation was made to the Department of Family Services, it was explored with the medical professional, Dr. Maida in this case, who routinely would staff the cases with the Department of Family Services to determine whether or not that was a reasonable explanation for the type of injury. As you can see from the testimony, Dr. Maida determined that that was not consistent with the manner of the injury, the lines on the child's face, the burn significance. And so based upon her medical opinion, the department proceeded with the unexplained injury theory for unfitness of parent as it relates to the termination. Initially, in the underlying...
But is it the case that Dr. Maida had not seen the child, was not familiar with the other experts' opinions and report?
Those are consistent. Dr. May, as you know, experts do not need to physically examine a child in order to provide expert testimony before the court. It's any testimony that may assist the trier of fact in a determination. In this case, both the hearing master determined it was appropriate for her to testify as an expert, and so did District Court Judge Tootin. Under those circumstances, she was provided with medical documentation, pictures of the injury, but she had not been provided with the medical documentation that subsequently was obtained from the state of Louisiana and became part of the prior decision in this case.
But on rehearing, she was presented with that information.
She was presented with that information.
And so could you go over why she persisted in her opinion, notwithstanding that additional information?
My understanding of her testimony was that based on the complete marking on the child's face, mm-hmm. it had the triangle shape, that she further testified that that would not be from a swiping, as we heard that iron may have fallen and touched the child's face. And so based upon the information that we had obtained by way of the mother's testimony from the prior hearings, the pictures of the mm-hmm. child's injuries, the significance of the child's injuries. The doctor, even in Louisiana, noted that it was a burn that was recovering. And so based upon the totality of those facts, she rendered the opinion that she provided to the district court.
Mr. Cordes, we're arguing this case because it is a matter of some legal significance. I wonder if you could offer your views about why this panel shouldn't consider the approaches taken in Minnesota with respect to the application and invocation of the Fifth Amendment.
And thank you, Your Honor. As it relates to the Fifth Amendment privilege that is apparently very relevant today, the Fifth Amendment should not be used as a shield to prevent the truth from being ascertained. And in this case, that is what the appellant is trying to assert, is that a broad rule that says that all these parents should be able to invoke the Fifth Amendment privilege to avoid having possible criminal charges filed against them and wait for the civil case, possibly push the civil case past a criminal hearing, which we have a lot of requests for. And given the timelines that we have for the protection of children, it would not be a very strong rule to impose upon the Department of Family Services as it relates to allowing them to invoke their Fifth Amendment privilege.
Ms. Molinar says that there are basically a couple of exceptions that she seems to acknowledge to the general prohibition to the use of that testimony. One would be that if the state were to grant immunity, sort of along the lines of what you folks are doing now, although it sounds like you couple that with a plea agreement of some kind or no contest plea, but as well, if the therapist doesn't insist on it or feels that the parent can be rehabilitated without the admission, how does that limit the state's ability to handle these matters?
Well, I can think of a number of contexts. We can talk about sex offenders who routinely need to engage in therapy. Part of their counseling requires that they make some sort of admission towards these sex acts in order for the therapist to believe that they can proceed with therapy. And we routinely hear about polygraphs in that type of counseling setting. I can talk about the substance abuse parents who routinely engage in substance abuse counseling, who I believe we would all agree need to make some sort of admission to start the process of understanding their substance abuse issues.
Mr. Cordes, but here the therapist was satisfied with the discussions the therapist had with the parent. It was a DFS supervisor who had not done therapy with the client who said that therapy cannot be effective without this admission. Why should the court have waited that at all? These were not competing experts. You had a therapist who examined her who said it was not necessary for their finding.
And if you look at the therapist's testimony, she specifically treated this as a neglect case, not as an abuse. She did not admit knowing that the hearing master who had heard the testimony found that Mr. Berry physically abused this child. She was treating the therapist, or the therapist was treating the mother based upon her explanation that this was merely an accident that occurred in her home and she was somehow responsible for that. That contradicted the actual findings of the court that she physically abused this child. So if you allow a parent to go into therapy and not address the specific issues that take them, it's ineffective. This court has ruled case plans can be complied with all day long, but if we don't see the behavioral changes in parents, then that's ineffective to secure the safety.
Wasn't there an indication by the expert in Louisiana that there had been behavioral changes with this mother?
The doctor.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. The doctor wasn't available for cross-examination. The court found that the report per se should be admitted because of the prior ruling of the Supreme Court in this case. And so there was really no finding that the mother had changed her behaviors by that doctor. That doctor in Louisiana was merely saying they saw the child had the burn mark, but based upon the information that individual had, which we're not even sure the extent of it, they were not saying it was abusive in nature. So I don't believe that that doctor in Louisiana could have seen any behavioral changes or indicated that by way of the information they had at the time of their observations.
Mr. Cordes, how would you have the court balance a parent having to have the Hobson's choice of choosing between their child and incriminating themselves? Obviously, there has to be some harmony between these two, because you shouldn't have to incriminate yourself to keep your child. And you shouldn't lose your child because you don't want to incriminate yourself. How do you suggest we handle that?
Well, I think the Ninth Circuit in Glanzner versus Glanzner has spoken about the negative inference. This court has also spoken about, in the civil context, having the choice between invoking your Fifth Amendment privilege or facing the possibility of a negative inference if the state can submit the necessary underlying facts to support that negative inference. I think that is a solid rule that protects parents as well as affords the agency the opportunity to protect children who have been in that home. If we just give parents a blanket privilege and say in abuse and neglect cases, if there's any potential for criminal prosecution, they don't need to say anything to the Department of Family Services, to a therapist, and we just are left with a lack of information, too many children will potentially go home to abusive homes. And so I think a blanket rule that just allows parents to assert their Fifth Amendment privilege is a travesty to children.
What about when defendants exercise their rights under a motion to suppress? So they testify in a motion to suppress pretrial. That can't be used affirmatively against them at trial unless they testify, so shield and sword. Why can't a similar procedure be adopted here? If they give testimony in a DFS proceeding, it can't be used affirmatively against them unless they testify to the contrary at the criminal proceeding.
It's possible. Obviously, we offer the no contest plea in the hopes that individuals will engage in therapy and not fear for the prosecution. So yes, is that a feasible rule that could be implemented? Of course it is. I think that when we start allowing abusive and neglectful parents to avoid coming to grips with the problem that brought them to the attention of the department and jeopardize the safety of the children, then we run the risk of reunifying children into unsafe homes. Because without knowing the foundation, the causation of the abuse or neglect, we jeopardize placing children back into homes where they have not been appropriately treated. You had the Ma decision that recently came down from this court where the mom was forcing the children to swallow the batteries. And under those circumstances, no counseling was done because she feared for criminal prosecution. They have a very hesitant nature when it comes to engaging in counseling services as long as there's a potential criminal case. And we know from abuse and neglect type criminal cases that the reality is almost every single parent in our system could face criminal charges. We don't file criminal charges against them just based on the sheer numbers of criminal cases that must be addressed by the court. But each parent in our system potentially could face a child abuse or neglect charge. And thereby, we would have all of these parents asserting their Fifth Amendment privileges without revealing what led to their involvement in our system or effective counseling for these parents to safely return their children to them. So I would urge you not to enter a rule that allows the parents to invoke the Fifth Amendment privilege without some consequence. And I think this court has spoken in the civil context, as well as the Ninth Circuit, that the appropriate remedy is for them to be allowed to invoke their Fifth Amendment privilege, and only a negative inference can be drawn by the court if, in fact, the state is successful in submitting sufficient evidence to prove a basis for the negative inference. So I urge you to continue that rule in this context.
Assuming that rule were present, was there substantial evidence still to warrant the termination of parental rights in this case?
Yes, there was.
What is the state's position on that?
That this parent is unfit by the nature of the injuries to this child. The parent neglected the child as a result of the injuries the child sustained. This parent also physically injured the child and did not effectively address the parental objectives for reunification, that the children, in this case, best interest would be served by the termination. We believe that the grounds set forth in 128.105, as well as the presumptions in 128.109 applied, there was substantial evidence to support the termination. I thank you for your time.
Before you address other issues, I wonder, counsel, if you could comment on the district court's reliance on either the presumption or other grounds for terminating parental rights. It's a little bit unclear to me which the court considered.
Yes, Your Honor, I do believe that the decision is very unclear, although I do think in part they were relying on the presumption that the child was out of the home 14 out of 20 months. First of all, that is a rebuttable presumption, which I do believe that we overcame by showing a strong bond with the children, her completion of her case plan, her compliance with two separate therapists that were both referred to her by the Department of Family Services. The first therapist actually was in contact with the Department of Family Services, and that therapist was given the same information of the classes that she would have been given in Nevada. And the second therapist actually had contact with Department of Family Services as well. So when the state says that this therapist did not go over certain things or misunderstood, I believe that that's simply disingenuous because they had contact with the Department of Family Services. Department of Family Services was not comfortable with her treatment, they could have told her. If there was another way they wanted to address it, they could have let Ms. Jane Fortune know. And then further, as stated in my brief, almost 2 years later, the children were actually sent to the same exact therapist, Ms. Jane Fortune, and that's because she's qualified. She is a therapist who has appropriately worked with children in this area and who has appropriately worked with parents in this area. So I think that we overcame that presumption, number one. Number two, I do believe it's a little unfair to use the timeline against the parents because the child has to be out of the home for 14 out of 20 months. So even in this case where right before the 14-month mark, she had completed her case plan because the last portion was parenting, which was completed July 1st, 2011. So right before the 14-month mark, when she's completed her case plan, it's now the state who isn't returning the child home. It's not through any fault of her own. And especially in a case where we had 9 months before they even adjudicated the plea. So it was 9 months before they even found these allegations to be true. Which takes me back to the transactional immunity the state spoke about. They spoke that parents are offered no contest pleas where that will not be used against them in criminal court. However, that only refers to pleas. If any parent chooses to go to trial, they are risking anything that they say be used against them in criminal court. And that is used against them to keep parents from going to trial. In a case like this, where there's not substantial evidence, there's very slight evidence that that the parent inflicted an injury on this child, yet they are requiring them to admit to doing that, then a parent runs into a unique situation. And here, where we're at TPR and we have behavioral change, I think that that's the important thing to look at. In all the other cases cited by the state, there was no behavioral change by those parents. And here we do have that. We have even the department saying that the mother had changed. And we have a very unique situation here where a child was actually born after this incident and has been appropriately cared for up to this point. So I don't know if there's any more that she could do to show that she has changed. I mean, she went to both therapists referred by the Department of Family Services, completed her case plan, stayed in contact with them, appropriately raised these children. There's really nothing else that can happen. And for them to discuss the negative inference, that is what happened here. There was a negative inference that she didn't testify, so they found it to be true against her. But now she's left in a situation where she's forced to admit to personally injuring this child. And mind you, the district court judge, did not make a finding that Ms. DeBerry herself injured this child. He only made a finding that this child was physically abused. And I think that's where we're running into a lot of problems, especially here, because there's not enough evidence to say that she herself injured this child, but we're requiring her to say that because that's the only thing that's left. There's numerous people testifying, including the Department of Family Services, that she completed her entire case plan. And there's direct testimony, which I quoted, where the Department of Family Services testified that the only reason they were going forward with termination of parental rights is because she refused to admit to burning this child. So when that's the only thing that's left, I think now we have the Fifth Amendment that has brought itself in.
Okay, thank you very much, counsel, for your excellent briefs and arguments today. The panel appreciates your input, and the case will stand submitted.